Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Every team, every topic, everywhere, this is Believe.
Ich warte seit Wochen auf diesen Tag und tanz vor Freude über den Asphalt, als wär's ein Rhythmus, als gäb's ein Lied, was mich immer weiter durch die Straßen zieht. Komm dir entgegen.
Hello and welcome to the Gegenpressing podcast. Welcome to another episode of the German Football Show. And as you may have already noticed, Mario Vett is not here. He's still on his holidays. We did manage to peel him away from the sunshine and joy and success of Hawaii to do a quick video on our YouTube channel after Saturday's game. So if you want to hear his opinions on what we're about to spend the next 40 minutes talking about, you can definitely get over there. But for now, Manu's enjoying the last kind of few hours of paradise before he has to return to Vancouver and German football. But as ever, I'm delighted to be joined by Matt Ford and our super sub, Seb Stafford-Bleuer, 2 weeks in a row now. This January signing's working out quite well for us, Seb. We're getting our money's worth.
Sure are. Like, it's 11 days into February and already 2 appearances.
I know, mate. It's like one of those kind of January loan deals that turns into a permanent move eventually, because like the striker you're replacing never quite recovers from his injury. You're the Boya Iglesias movie of the Gegenpressing podcast.
Manu Vett never to return to Vancouver properly.
he's the Josip Stanisic to the Gegenpressing podcast.
Oh, timely.
Very timely, very timely. Does that make Manu Sasha Bowie? I don't know. Matt, you're of course here. How are you doing? You were of course at the game, which we'll jump into in finer detail in a moment, but how did you get on getting through the carnival crowds and getting to and from the game?
Yeah, it was okay. I've got my hat ready for tomorrow for the big Rosenmontag parade. So that's really a carnival's in full swing, and nowhere more so than Leverkusen, I think. Dusseldorf, famous for carnival. Cologne, famous for carnival. Mainz, maybe even Koblenz. Leverkusen less so, but the biggest party in town this weekend. It really was a potentially historic day in Leverkusen.
Yeah, I was saying to someone just as the game was finishing up that if Leverkusen actually had any decent bars, they'd be full of fans celebrating like there was no tomorrow, but such a thing does not exist. Believe me, I've went looking for them once or twice over the years, so I'm sure they probably took the short train into Cologne. But yeah, we've got plenty to discuss, guys. Of course, with a huge breakdown of this game, and we'll talk about it right after this break. It's playoff time, and the usual suspects are heading to Vegas for the championship. And our partner, BetOnline, is your number one source for football odds, stats, trends, and lines. With everything from point spreads to hundreds of bets on everything from the coin toss to the colour of Gatorade, BetOnline is the number one source for your championship wagering. Head to BetOnline and join today to get all the action. BetOnline, the game starts here. So yeah, Bayer Leverkusen 3, Bayern Munich 0. Guys, we've got so much to talk about. I want to shine a light on Xabi Alonso and the amazing work he's done at Leverkusen, but I think first and foremost we really have to touch on how Bayern Munich and Thomas Tuchel in particular approached this game. Seb, it seems fair to me to say that it was quite an unorthodox lineup. It was a back three. We had Sacha Boey as a left back. You know, Kimmich missing, obviously through injury or fitness issues. So a kind of, you know, ad hoc midfield as well. And, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into these games and these performances, especially at this level where the margins are so small. But I think a lot of Barn fans probably walked away from that game thinking the club almost kind of shot themselves in the foot before a ball had been kicked.
Yeah, it was interesting as well because Tuchel kind of doubled down on it afterwards, Stefan, said, well, no, I picked the same team again. And if you look at the pattern of that game, I remember seeing the Bayern lineup and thinking that's asking an awful lot of Pavlovic, like, to be the kind of the platform. Because Goretzka, to me, Goretzka is an eight. He needs an orchestrator behind him. He needs a kind of a stable base. And I don't feel like Pavlovic is quite experienced enough to have provided that. Good player that he's clearly going to become. And everything looked very awkward. And I'm glad you mentioned the Sacha Boey decision because, goodness, he looked awkward out on the left. Because, I mean, at times he had, obviously, Stanisic playing against him, but Teller drifting out wide as well. And everywhere you looked in that Bayern side, there was disconnection, space. And it was remarkably easy, like, for Leverkusen to play through them. I think when you have a game like that, which has been anticipated for months, you expect it to be a little bit cagey, even though we know how Leverkusen play, you expect a little bit of inhibition. And yet there was none of that. It was so easy, to the point where it was actually quite shocking. And then doubly so when Tuchel kind of refuses to sort of acknowledge, okay, maybe, like, even though he clearly wasn't fit, Kimmich might have been the better option there. Guerrero, you could have played as a kind of a six potentially, just for a bit of experience. It was an absolute mess.
Yeah. What do you think about the decision to play Dier at central defence? Because, you know, I took one look at that lineup. I was actually doing some TV work ahead of the game, and I was on camera before we went live, and the lineups literally came in like 30 seconds before I went on, and I had the producer in my ear saying, what do you think of that lineup? But I had it looked at on my phone, and I couldn't make heads or tails of it, to be perfectly honest with you. It's just, obviously, they do these things like in a numerical order, so you're trying to like add up the central defenders and fullbacks, and the only kind of...
Doing a bit of TV, producer in my ear. Who's this? Who's this that we're talking to tonight?
International Bundesliga pundit extraordinaire.
Can only confirm that exactly the same conversations were taking place in the media center at the Bayer Arena when the team dropped. I found myself as well, yeah, in a packed media center, looking down that lineup, thinking that looks like five at the back, looks like a back three, looks like potentially Eric Dier in a sort of sweeper libero role. And yeah, so it proved. The thinking behind Tuchel's decision was to go, yeah, to match Leverkusen's five at the back, but of course Alonso himself had made the change to four at the back, which immediately rendered that problematic. And then, yeah, as it then developed throughout the first half, Seb's already mentioned how out of place Sacha Boey looked. I thought he looked solid against Gladbach when he came on for his debut. But he was in his favourite position at right back. I was sat next to a colleague from the Munich Abendzeitung, and she said straight away, before the ball was kicked, but away from his favourite position, this is potentially problematic. And as it proved, you mentioned him being up against Stanisic and Teller at times, and they actually double teamed him at one point. I think down by the touchline, they literally teamed up on him physically to win the ball. So that was problematic all the way through. Eric Dier gave the ball away in several dangerous occasions, you know, trying to open play, trying to launch Bayern's build-up, and balls were going astray. There were longer balls where he clearly wasn't on the same wavelength with either Kim Min-jae or Boey on the left. It didn't work from start to finish. And then, as we might get onto it in a sec later, Tuchel didn't change to half-time either, which was also baffling.
Yeah, the weird thing I found as well, that the baffling context of all this, is that he's got a perfectly good left back sitting on the bench in Guerrero. You know, it's not as if, obviously, Davies is missing, which is one of the best left backs in the world, left wing back, whatever you want to call him. And obviously, no one's going to do the job that Davies did. But Guerrero's a player who's been doing that job admittedly, rather inconsistently for Dortmund over the years, but there's a reason that they signed him. And I think I said to Manu on the video we did on YouTube after the game, they didn't sign Guerrero to be a number six. They signed him because he could obviously fill in at left back when necessary. Of course, he can play number six, and he did a decent job of that for Dortmund last season. But Seb, am I maybe overthinking this and thinking, you know, it was almost Mourinho-esque and like that kind of obtuse kind of decision to play a stubborn start in 11 just to kind of bite your tongue or bite your thumb at the board almost, you know, to say, well, you guys have signed me this left back, but he's not good enough, so I'm going to play this right back in place, and I'm going to use this, you know, Eric Dier, this kind of backup of the backup central defender as my star defender in this game. And it felt very much like he was almost, I still can't for the life of me try and figure out why he was trying to put these kind of round pegs in a square hole or vice versa. I still can't seem to see the logic behind it.
Well, I didn't have such a problem with Dier because I think clearly like his best days are probably behind him. And he's a very middling centre-back at best. But if you can surround him with a bit of pace and you just use him to distribute and the options ahead of him exist, he can be effective. The boy one, I have a bit more of a problem with because I think, like you touched on the right, Guerrero is signed as a fullback or a wingback. But within the context of a single game, like, Guerrero's versatility allows you to be much more agile tactically. Like, you can do different things with him because you can push him in field if you need to. You can push him out wide. Fantastic set piece option. I felt like the decision to put Boy in that position in this game was kind of irresponsible because you've bought a player. He hasn't been at a club of this size. Like, Galatasaray is a very large club, I understand that, but in terms of like a significant game within a major league, he hasn't played on that kind of occasion before, and you put him in a situation where he's probably destined to fail against one of the most dynamic teams in European football. I feel like whatever your motive, that's not the right thing to do, because you've invested 30 million euros in a player, and all of a sudden you've kind of hung him out to dry with the fan base. Time will tell if that's the case, whether he gets the opportunity to redeem himself. But it was very strange. I so much of Tuchel's demeanor is about kind of, I'm not sure what the right word is, but he's so volatile and he's so, I think that's probably the best word, Stefan. Yeah, it's maddening. And like sometimes he does that thing where at the end of a disappointing performance, he throws his hands up in front of the media and goes, I don't know why this happened. I don't know why. I remember him doing that as a Super Cup and just thinking, what weird tone to set for this season. Because you see that at Chelsea too. And it's strange. I still don't really understand the logic behind any of it. It still doesn't make sense 24 hours later.
He's been a difficult personality to deal with wherever he's been in his career. I think it's not often been one of his great strengths. I wouldn't take that away from him. But it certainly doesn't look right in terms of the optics, and I accept that that's not his main concern. He would argue as well that he doesn't care. But it's not particularly good look, particularly when you do, by the very nature of the role, have a quite media-facing presence and you have to deal with the questions. Sometimes it comes off for him. I think back to the game that Seb, me and you were at in Dortmund earlier this year when Bayern had won away with a 4-0 win. And yeah, Tuchel was justified in vindicating all his decisions. And if anything, he played that wrong as well by going overly offensive and aggressive in his media dealings, repeating in about five or six interviews how, don't ask me, ask the experts because you're clearly all idiots. And yeah, so I'm like laughing in hindsight, but he was taking a similarly aggressive stance with the media yesterday in Leverkusen, I think breaking off one interview with Sportschau by effectively threatening a bet with the reporter regarding the build up to the opening goal. Now, maybe he's got a point because the reporter was arguing, Bayern have conceded this sort of goal before, and Leverkusen has scored this sort of goal before, where the ball is played quickly across the box and the wing back on the far side gets up quickly to provide the extra option. And Tuchel was arguing what you're suggesting, you predicted the number six drifting out to the left, firing a ball through Dario Pomicano's legs to the right back on the far side. I'll bet you've never seen that before. So it descended into this really, really overly detailed, quite unpleasant argument in front of the press in the middle of an interview where you think, who are you really helping here with that sort of approach?
Matt, did you find it weird that he picked that hill to die on? Because it's like, the first goal is that happens because you've put a player in an unfamiliar role. Yeah. Like, and Boy doesn't react quickly enough, and you know he's in an awkward position, so that's what you'd expect. That is not the place to pick a fight if you're Thomas Tuchel, because like, you're right, like the circumstances leading up to that are unfamiliar and it's not typical, but like, reactive defending depends on players understanding what's around them, and you've asked someone to do something that he's not comfortable doing. It's a crazy argument to pick.
Absolutely. First of all, just to maybe absolve Sacha Boey from blame as well a little bit, he was to blame for that, but he wasn't the only Bayern defender who fell asleep from that throw-in. That ball shouldn't be getting that far in the first place, but yeah, he is also at fault for completely losing track of Stanisic. But it also wasn't the only hill that Tuchel picked to die on. It seemed to be an almost planned defence for some of the Bayern staff and hierarchy post-match, that they've actually been really in the game for 15 minutes. The different 15 minutes to what I watch.
I
expression that you've just made, Seb, with your eyes. I made that expression directly with eye contact to Jan-Christian Driesen, who was the CEO, who was speaking to the press afterwards in the mixer, and he made it. He said, "Oh, 15 minutes. We're really in the game." I looked at him and caught his eye and went, "Eh." What game were you watching? But you know, that's why he's the finance man and not on the touchline. But you know, Tuchel also repeated that line that, oh, we were in the game for 15 minutes. If Bayern were in the game for 8 minutes, according to my notes, and that only because Leverkusen were slowly finding their way into playing with a back four. That's the only reason. So for Tuchel to pick these hills to die on, it was strange and not particularly helpful for his own cause. Because we'll get onto it later. He's, as much as he got it wrong on Saturday, he's not Bayern's big issue at the moment, but that's a bigger topic.
Yeah. The interesting thing as well is I previewed this game with the excellent Marie Schulte-Bochum last week, and we discussed Tuchel's kind of personality issues. And one of the points I made was that the fascinating thing with Tuchel is that he has such an obvious admiration for Pep Guardiola tactically, the way he tries to maybe hold himself as this kind of head coach that clubs bring in to build projects around. But the one thing that they can't contrast so starkly with, in my opinion, I mean, Seb, jump in if you disagree, because you obviously cover the Premier League a lot more than I do, but Pep in public bends over backwards to almost avoid confrontation to an extent. You know, if this game had happened for a Pep Guardiola team, he'd come out and say, well, you know what, Bayer Leverkusen, they're the best team in the world, they're the absolute best. And when the question was asked of Sacha Boey, say, look, he's the best defender there was, the best left, like, he's fantastic, he played really, really well. And, you know, there's probably some examples where he does contradict that kind of general rule of thumb, but it's almost like a cliche now in English football that Pep more or less flat up lies on camera to protect his players in public. Now, what happens in the changing room, completely different, and maybe that's where him and Tuchel are very similar, but where, and of course, you could probably argue that Pep's probably had far more comfortable jobs than Tuchel, so, you know, there's different circumstances there. But I tend to find that when it comes to almost like the PR of being a top-class head coach, Guardiola seems to have that more or less tied down. He knows how to avoid these questions. He knows how to avoid falling into the traps that these kind of post-match interviews put on him. And it's not easy, because we've seen, for example, Jurgen Klopp falls into them all the time. But Tuchel, whether out of choice or simply because of his personality style, he just can't seem to help himself. And it seems to mean, and it means that he gets into these kind of public spats with, you know, as Matt said in the show, you know, whether it's Hamann or Lothar Matthäus. But even this season alone, he's basically got into these kind of weird public spats with his own players, where week to week he's having this constant debate about whether Joshua Kimmich's a number six. I just feel like we would never get that with Pep Guardiola, Seb. I mean, maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but it's weird that he has such admiration for Pep, but there's that glaring oversight from Tuchel.
I feel he's a more emotional human being than Guardiola. Like, Guardiola as a person, I think, is quite strange. I think he's quite an odd bloke.
No, you're right. He's a little psychotic.
He's awkward. And
the best coaches are, by their very nature.
Yeah, of course. And it's kind of, it's a prerequisite, really. Like, yeah. if you're that obsessive and that detail orientated, and I think a lot of the mystique around Guardiola comes from him saying weird things to be weird, and the media interpreting that as some kind of, you know, as if it has some sort of deeper significance. Like, there's that, you mentioned it, Stefan, the trait he has of, like, you know, before he's about to face a team who are really about to get a hammering, he praises them as the very best team that's ever played the game. Like, I remember him doing that to Sarri's Napoli, and I remember him praising Dante all those years ago and saying he wanted like 1,000 Dantes in his team and he'd never lose a game again. Tuchel, to me, I think one of the problems for him is, unlike Guardiola, who's associated with an epoch-changing football team and a style of the game, like, Tuchel's been very successful. Goodness, he nearly took Paris Saint-Germain to a Champions League title. Can you imagine taking that circus to the top of European football? Like, it's an incredible achievement, potentially.
On crutches
as well. Like, so at the same time, though, I don't think kind of he has the same level of gravitas. So when he talks and when he's a bit weird, I think people focus in on the kind of the oddity of it rather than necessarily what they do with Guardiola, which is to kind of lean into the kind of, well, he's sort of like a slightly opaque genius who's impossible to comprehend. But it is, like, I remember when he moved to Chelsea, everybody talking back to kind of the difficulties he'd had politically at Dortmund, some of the difficulties he had at Paris Saint-Germain, and thinking, you're going to Chelsea, really? And you're going to deal with the kind of the currents in that swimming pool. And then Bayern Munich is another deeply political club, and Matt hit the nail on the head. He is not the problem at Bayern, but he's kind of an accelerant, isn't he? Like, that personality of his.
I wonder if, as well, he's almost, again, this is not to overly defend Thomas Tuchel. I think he absolutely comes out of this weekend particularly badly for various reasons. But I wonder if he's also a little bit of a victim of the ongoing switch around at the moment at Bayern, and the lack of a sporting director, because he's there in Christoph Freund, but a sporting director who's still finding his feet. Christoph Freund,
who didn't appoint him,
yeah. Yeah. But also has taken his time in settling into the role, increasing his visibility and his public sort of persona quite slowly. I've only really seen one extended interview with him that he did with DAZN in Germany recently. But apart from that, he's not particularly outspoken publicly, as perhaps before him Hasan Salihamidzic was, and previous figures before him. Again, you can debate as to whether that was a good thing for Bayern or not, whether Salihamidzic speaking out all the time was a good thing, probably not. But I suspect that the more Christoph Freund settles into his public facing role as a sporting director, maybe he can sort of take on some of the questions which Thomas Tuchel is finding himself having to field, particularly because Tuchel's still necessarily operating with the team which he would like to have had put together. There is that mitigating factor still. Because by all accounts, at least on the training pitch, things do seem to be going quite well. Thomas Müller, for all his pretty explosive comments in his interview, nevertheless made a point. Maybe he was just playing politics and saying that on the training pitch it's fine. His problem's not the coach. He made a point of saying that. By all accounts, it was okay in training in the week up to the game. But for Müller to say it's not the coach's fault, but then to talk about having no freedom to play football, overcomplicating things in their heads, not having the freedom to play the way Leverkusen did.
Having no fun. I felt that was a really telling comment.
Exactly, there. But that is an indirect, surely yeah. That's indirectly, even yeah. Subconsciously, in the Tuchel. Of course,
it's a commentary on the environment, right? Hell. Like, it's, yeah.
Well, let's just dive into this now. We were going to do Alonso, but we'll do Alonso after this, because it's probably worth just kind of segueing into this point and talking about Tuchel's situation at Bayern, because there's a lot of talk on social media. We had a lot of Bayern fans in our subscriber chat calling for his head, you know, bloodthirsty, as you would expect from football fans at full time. There was some pictures taken in the way ground, or in the way stand, I think it was, in the Seb, correct me if I'm wrong, of saying no Tuchel out. Let's just discuss that in itself, you know, is basically, as Matt mentioned, and we can hit the nail on the head, whichever way we want, but, you know, is this issue Tuchel or is this issue Bayern? Because, you know, it seems it's always a very, very easy thing to say, let's just sack the head coach, wipe the slate clean and start again. But, I mean, Seb, where do you land on this?
No, well, I think if you're going to go down the sack the coach pathway, like you got to have something, you got to have an alternative to propose. Like, okay, so you sack the coach, and who do you replace him with? Like, I saw like Jose Mourinho's name mentioned. Conveniently, Mourinho has let it be known that he's learning German. He's saying, "Grow up!" Like, Jose Mourinho is a coach for teams who want a bit of an ego stroke. Like, you want the big personality, like. The idea of him in that environment is ludicrous, absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I'd want to see it because I think weird stuff would happen that we could talk about, but as a practical solution, no, not at all. So, like, what is the option? And also, like...
Can I just say, by the way, I'm firmly on the Mourinho to the Bundesliga bandwagon, but I agree that maybe Munich's not the best place for him.
Well, I mean, it's also... If you're gonna sack someone, you're sacking on the basis that they've built a team, and it doesn't work and it's not effective. I don't believe that this side is a reflection of the way that Thomas Tuchel wants to play, based on the teams he's created elsewhere. I also have no sense of Bayern Munich's dimensions as a football club or what their 5-year strategy is or what, like, if you, the January transfer window is a really good example, right? Because you have shortages in your team. And it feels like previous Bayern Munich hierarchies would have a strategy for who is to fill which position over a long period of time. And what you have instead is Eric Dier, because he's available. Eric Dier wasn't good enough to play for Tottenham. I mean, it breaks my heart to say that because I'm a Tottenham fan, but it's true. Wasn't having his contract renewed, so he was low hanging fruit to kind of plug a gap in your squad. Sasha Bowie, okay, talented guy, but Turkey to the Bundesliga is a little bit of a jump, especially if you're going to shove him straight into the middle of a title decider. Mazraoui, not really sold on it. And actually, if you go back a few years and you look at how some of the signings have been treated and the lack of attune that the Bayern have been able to get out of them, Gravenberch is the one, I feel, that has really under-delivered on where he was. So... Well, you have all of these moving parts, and the answer to the question cannot be, let's have some more fluidity, right? Which is what a new coach is. In the abstract sense, that is what you're doing. You're saying, right, well, we're going to start again now. We're going to bring something different in and another unknown factor. We don't know how well it's going to go. And there's no, you know, if you go back 5 years and Julian Nagelsmann is doing wonderful things at RB Leipzig, okay, that's a little bit of a different conversation because you've got something interesting to invest in. But there is nothing there that is obviously... going to improve Bayern that I can see, at least. I might be wrong, but there's no obvious solution, and that's the question you have to answer before you go down the kind of right Tuchel Raus, which for me is very reactionary.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that Tuchel's record for Bayern is actually still better than Nagelsmann's. He's averaging 2.3 points per game in the Bundesliga, where Nagelsmann averaged 2.19. I've got an interesting comparison for you here, Matt, which has just kind of popped into my head. I was trying to, as I was gathering my thoughts and listening to what Seb was saying and thinking about Bayern, and I completely agree with what Seb's saying. You look at the kind of players that they brought in over the last kind of couple of years, how they haven't quite gelled, how they've kind of swung from one type of head coach to another type of head coach to another, all while the kind of spine of that team, in my opinion, has been a long-term decline for some time, whether it's Manuel Neuer, Leon Goretzka, maybe Joshua Kimmich, you can make an argument for Serge Gnabry, maybe even Alphonso Davies, whether that's physical, technical, or just simply, you know, he's not interested in playing for Bayern anymore. It all seems a bit like post Ferguson Man United to me, but instead of the head coach being the guy who's moved on and left that power shift, it's maybe, you know, the Sebastian Hodes or Rummenigge or something like that. It feels there's a lot of money being spent. There's a lot of big stars being brought in, but there's not a lot of joint up thinking. And as a result, we've just kind of got this convoluted mess of superstars in a team that don't look like they're having fun or winning games.
There's a little bit of a mess, a little bit of insecurity, a little bit of a restructuring going on. I absolutely would not go as far as to compare it to Manchester United post Ferguson. I think that's mismanagement. That's a circus on a whole other level. Like I said, it's carnival time. It's been carnival in Manchester for 10 years. Anyway, that's a different topic. There is a restructure going on by it, absolutely. They are looking to move on. We've talked about the restructuring in the hierarchy on several podcasts, the movements at the top, how it didn't work with the whole Salihamidzic, Oliver Kahn, Axis. Now they're going again with Jan-Christian Driesen in that role, potentially Max Eberl coming into the sport director or the director of sport role. We've talked about that before. Like I said earlier, Christoph Freud still growing into his role as sporting director. All those all those roles, plus also the role of Michael Knepper, the chief scout. Is he going to stay? Is he going to go? All of those issues need to come into place first, I think, before you start demanding Tuchel raus. And again, I repeat, that's not to say that he's without blame. He absolutely was to blame on Saturday, for example. If in the meantime, while that restructuring is all going on, but I trust Bayern to get it right. They absolutely have form for it. Bayern's history is littered with, well, I say littered, two major examples of high-profile failure in 1999 and 2012, followed very shortly later by, you know, era-defining historical success. So I wouldn't write Bayern Munich off completely. They are in that process of restructuring, and if that means that for the first time in 12 years Bayern don't win the league or indeed don't win a single trophy, it's absolutely not the end of the world. It should have happened last year, if we're being honest, and you know that was down to the Borussia Dortmund that it didn't. It's not the end of the world. It doesn't mean that Thomas Tuchel is a complete failure. It doesn't mean that Bayern's restructuring is completely behind the pace and destined to fail. The draw is very much still out. I would be tempted just to leave the toys in the pram for the time being. As tempting as it is, and I understand the reaction, particularly after Saturday, because they were diabolical on and off the pitch. And the reactions of the various Bayern officials surrounding the game, the performance from the players themselves on the pitch. Even the away support seemed resigned to the fact that they're all singing, you won't win the league, you know, only Bayern will win the league. But they didn't believe it. But if that doesn't happen for 1 year, it's not the end of the world.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's playoff time, and the usual suspects are heading to Vegas for the championship. And our partner BetOnline is your number one source for football odds, stats, trends and lines. With everything from point spreads to hundreds of bets on everything from the coin toss to the colour of Gatorade, BetOnline is the number one source for your championship wagering. Head to BetOnline and join today to get all the action. BetOnline, the game starts here. I might push back on that slightly just because you're absolutely right, of course. We shouldn't be throwing the toys at the pram, and hyperbole is, you know, reserved for people like us, I suppose, who talk on podcasts and try and get people to listen to them. But, you know, if you do kind of step back and look at this team, you know, they won the league by tripping over the finish line, but it's the lowest points total they've ever picked up since 2011. I checked before we went on air. They haven't got past the quarterfinals of the Champions League since 2020. They don't look anywhere near doing that this season. In fact, a lot of people are predicting they could struggle against Lazio. And, you know, yes, they brought in Christoph Freund. They're going to try this new system of bringing in young players. But, you know, the reason I've mentioned the Man United comparison is because every single season they just chop and change. You know, 1 minute it's Salihamidžić, 1 minute it's Christoph Freund, 1 minute it's Nagelsmann, 1 minute it's Tuchel. If it's not going to be Tuchel, who comes in next season?
But I don't think it has been a regular chopping and changing. There's only actually been two big changes. One of them has been to bring in the Salihamidžić, Oliver Kahn axes, and that then failed, and they still won the league, but has been adjudged to have been a failure, and I accept that it wasn't working out. And the second change has been to move on from that, what we have now. So I don't think the argument that they chop and change all the time actually holds water.
Yeah. Well, I guess the other thing as well is that unlike Man United, Bayern can actually afford to just kind of drift for a while, sir, because, you know, for all we love the German football, it's obviously not as competitive as the Premier League, where there's two or three kind of super clubs waiting to kind of step into their hole. Whereas, you know, the club we'll talk about in a moment who are stepping in this season, but the likes of Dortmund and Leipzig haven't been able to take advantage of Bayern's kind of malaise over the years.
No, I suppose not. I mean, the one thing I'll add to this is that, like, I feel it's quite interesting the kind of the conversation around Harry Kane, in that that in itself represented a little bit of a departure from kind of traditional thinking. Go and break the German transfer record because you can and because this player is available for the, you know, in an unusual situation. It's a very, I find it, I think, quite disheartening to watch the response to Bayern's situation from back in England, because without Kane's form, without the contributions of Lucas Hernandez, who I think has been really, really good this season for much of it, like, Bayern are nowhere near Leverkusen. Like, yesterday's game is not even really a title decider. It's a kind of Bayern are 10 points back rather than two. And I'm trying to think of it in terms of what it means for the Bundesliga. I mean, like, in terms of how valuable is it for someone like Harry Kane to succeed in Germany, to succeed in the Champions League. If he doesn't do that in this Bayern Munich team, whether it's representative of what they are generally or not, is that quite damaging to German football? I don't know. I'm posing a question because it's been on my mind since the end of yesterday's game, and because there are so many people who seem to tune into yesterday's game without having watched anything that preceded it or any of the games that preceded it, and have just kind of dropped in to have a little bit of a laugh at Kane's misfortune and at Eric Dier. It's just an interesting situation. I didn't answer your question in any way at all, Stefan, but I thought I'd just get that in there.
So, right, you chose to just talk about two Tottenham players.
It was
players,
the only
which...
place that was going to fit, and I had to have my say. But it's frustrating. It's really frustrating. Like, I've seen Kane come over. I've seen him adapt to Bavarian life really well, embrace living in Germany in a way that English people generally don't, playing really well. Him also being one of the only reasons that Bayern are actually competitive in my mind, because I think if you take Kane away and you take Sané away, they have been absolutely awful in so many other different areas of the pitch. And so now you get people kind of turning up in February, 5 months into the season, and judging it on a single 90-minute period. It does my head in. It drives me crazy.
And yeah, I'm going to provide the segue here for Stefan. The reason is quite simple, that he didn't have a touch on Saturday.
It's completely marginalised.
Because Xavi Alonso made absolutely the right call, one of several bang-on calls.
Yeah,
there you go, Stefan.
Yeah, I was going to say there will be probably everyone who isn't a Bayern fan probably screaming into their phones, being like, "When are these guys going to talk about Leverkusen?" And the opportunity is now. The time is now. If you allow me some more hyperbole, let me just sprinkle some more on this episode, Matt. When I was watching the kind of post-match scenes of the players, the Leverkusen players going over to the ultras in Leverkusen, and, you know, Hideki in the stand with the microphone and Xabi Alonso going over, it honestly felt to me a bit like, obviously it was a great moment, it's great advertising for the Bundesliga, you know, people will be looking at it and thinking, finally, here's a team who might challenge Bayern. But even if you just kind of narrow it in to those football fans in that stadium, what a moment, what a historical moment. You know, they might not go on and win the title, they might do a typical Leverkusen thing, but at least everyone there that day will be able to say, I remember 15 years ago when Xabi Alonso was a head coach here, the whole world was watching, and we absolutely thumped Bayern Munich. We made Bayern, the record meister, look like the most average team in Germany. That to me felt like something worth celebrating, not just for Leverkusen but for the Bundesliga itself.
Whatever happens by the end of the season, something changed last night in Leverkusen. I've been living in this part of Germany for almost 8 years. I go to watch Bayer Leverkusen very, very regularly. Admittedly, and with respect to Leverkusen, often for the opponents than for Bayer Leverkusen themselves. And I freely admit that, which doesn't excuse the fact that Leverkusen themselves also have often played very, absolutely spectacular attacking football. They just don't defend. So it's always been a good laugh watching Bayer Leverkusen. It's been entertaining. However, I've also been there in empty stadiums, half-empty Europa League group stage games. Leverkusen is, it's sandwiched in between Cologne, in between Dusseldorf, in between Schalke, Mönchengladbach, Dortmund. Doesn't play a big role. It really doesn't. Something changed last night. I've never heard an atmosphere like that of Bayer Leverkusen. I've never heard noise like it. I wanted to ask Xavi Alonso in the press conference if he sensed a change, if something had changed. And I couldn't ask the question because the press room was too full and I didn't have a microphone because there were 160 accredited journalists. I've never seen that.
Give some context, Matt, for people who don't know the trade, like how many you think there usually are at those kind of games.
I'd suggest maximum 30.
Yeah, last time I was there, 40, if there were more than 30, maybe? I'd be amazed.
Yeah, I walked into the media, and again, I know, little violins out. I walked to the media centre at 1.5 hours before kickoff. I couldn't get a seat to sit down. So it was absolutely rammed. I've never seen anything like. And then there was a whole different even before kickoff. There was a different atmosphere around the place. I was reading in the fanzine that the ultras brought out, and they had their introduction. This is a time for a changing of the guard. It's obvious to anyone. We're the best team in this league. This is time to show it. German football needs it. We need it. Our city needs it. And if anyone's going to do it, why not us? And the stadium responded. I glanced, in the other direction after the goal of the Nordkurve, the terrace behind the goal, and there were bodies dressed in carnival suits, so different Marvel characters and Disney characters and animals and stuff flying everywhere. And I've never heard noise like it. Something changed last night. There's some belief that this is possible.
Yeah, I saw a few Rudi Völler's in the crowd last night, not just the one sitting next to Julian Nagelsmann, due to carnival. Seb, I honestly don't think we could praise enough the tactical kind of victory that we saw here from Alonso. Of course, we talked about how Tuchel kind of made a lot of errors in his setup, and how Bayern maybe shot themselves in the foot. But equally, when we saw that starting 11 for Leverkusen and the fact that there's no striker in the team, Adli's playing up front, Teller's in for Frimpong, Andrik's in there instead of, obviously, Palacios is out injured and things like that. I honestly thought, we've seen this so many times before. A last minute injury to the kind of title hope. Contenders, and it all comes crumbling down. It's almost always Dortmund. It's almost always revolves around the half-fit Jude Bellingham or Erling Haaland being rushed back from some sort of surgery. Never quite works out. But in this case, it was actually Xabi Alonso, playing some sort of tactical masterclass, and clearly looked at how Bayern have played this season and thought, well, I could stick Patrick Schick in there. I could try and park my team on the Bayern box like I've done with every other team, as I've done against every other opponent this season. But instead, I'm going to play the quick players. I'm going to use Florian Wirtz to play off them. And they had so much success from it, didn't they?
Yeah, there were a couple of moments when, particularly in the first half, when Adli went through on goal and he didn't take his chance, but you thought, like, his pace in itself just seemed to rattle and disturb Bayern straight away. Like, I really like the way that, Teller played predominantly from the right, but I really liked his influence through the middle. And there were little things all over the lineup. Like, I know that Eben Dzeko likes to play as a left-sided centre-back in a three rather than a two. Obviously, he's playing on the right initially when they're in a four to start with, and he played very, very well. Granit Xhaka, we've talked about an awful lot, just his orchestrating work and how valuable he is to the side. I thought Andrić was superb. given the kind of what his limitations are perceived to be as a player, I thought he was extremely effective in the middle of the pitch. And Wirtz, I wrote on Twitter before the game, In fact, I'm not doing that. I wrote on Twitter, not X, that my main hope was to see Florian Wirtz show what a good player he is when so many new people he probably wouldn't watch German football week to week were watching. And I feel like Alonso's great success was to put enough width into his side to allow Wirtz to dominate the middle of the pitch and play and orchestrate and playmake in the way that you know he can do. And he looked the highest compliment I can pay him is that he looked like one of those interior players that Guardiola used at Barcelona. It looked like an Iniesta type on Saturday night. I thought he was absolutely sensational and such a great story, because when you suffer an injury as serious as he did at that age, and you're a player who, because of the way he carries the ball, he invites contact so often, that he's come back as a better player and has continued to evolve into what I think is he's going to be worth goodness knows what by the time he eventually leaves Leverkusen, but just a wonderful performance and creating the platform for him to operate within and really just to dice up Bayern was Alonso's sort of great success. And yeah, there's so many different things that go into that. But then it's interesting to bring up the Dortmund thing, because like you always feel those Dortmund games, like you said, they relied on all the kind of the variables falling on Dortmund's side. So Bellingham being fit, for instance, or like not having to drop Emre Can into a centre-half position, all these little things. And if you look at Leverkusen, if you look at the side the Leverkusen sent out, there's all sorts of obstacles that Alonso had to navigate. Half-fit players. He lost Frimpong a few weeks ago to that injury. He hasn't quite been fit since. I know he came on, but he hasn't quite been the same since. Tell has been integrated. Stanisic has become really important. Like these little things that in another coach's hands become speed bumps, haven't. And yeah, it was really nice to see, because like you couldn't help but have that sinking feeling when you saw the kind of the pieces drop out. Boniface having to go off to AFCON, Kasona go off to AFCON as well, because to be honest, like we haven't even mentioned him, and he's one of the best players of the first 3 or 4 months of their season. Absolutely fantastic. So just a great success and huge, like a great moment for the Alonso brand, if that's not too much of a horrible phrase to use, just because it shows kind of his I suppose his agility as a coach.
Yeah, he's turned negatives into positives. Yeah. Like you said, the big question before Christmas was how are Leverkusen going to deal with some of the Africa Cup of Nations absentees, and they had that sort of dress rehearsal game against Bochum, where he intentionally left them all out, and they still won 4-0, I think. And he's turned them into positives. The fact that he was, I say, forced in inverted commas to start with no out-and-out striker in Adli and Teller, yeah, had that double effect. First of all, obviously provided that issue with pace on the break that Bayern have, and that did prove to be an issue. But as you said, Seb, also opened up space for Wirtz to do whatever he wanted in midfield. So he had that double positive. So he's turned one, what you think is a negative on paper, into two double positive effects. Genius coaching. I did wonder before the first goal whether Leverkusen were going to maybe pay for the lack of clinicalness.
Yeah, me too.
That perhaps Schick would have brought, or Boniface, had he been fit, would have brought, because a couple of chances did go begging when I think, first of all, Teller capitalised on that Upamecano mistake, and then the chance went begging. Adli in the build to the goal, obviously Upamecano got back and managed to clear. But obviously immediately after that they've taken the lead and the game changes. But I did wonder whether they're a little bit profligate in the first sort of 15-20 minutes. But didn't prove to be an issue in the long term.
I wonder if like, because one of the things I love the range of Boniface's like contribution, like you can drop him into a number 10 role and does pretty creative things with the ball. I wouldn't say he's the most clinical player in front of goal. Like he's someone that will have a few chances before he scores. But then maybe that conditions you as a side to think, okay, well, we'll just keep creating. We're not going to live and die off that one chance that we need to take, and you know that it's over. I mean, like Boniface probably should have won the game in Munich back in September, or say August, September, whenever it was. Like he had a couple of chances where, like, I think a player who'd been at the club a little bit longer probably wouldn't have snapped at the chance that he did. But
yeah, like it's just a great footballing performance. Like if you look at the sort of the construction of the goals, they all come from slightly different situations. Obviously, the third one is an anomaly, a wonderful one, like just ridiculous. But both goals are completely different. And actually, like to take it full circle, like for Tuchel to say, well, no one saw the goal coming from there. Well, yeah, but then that's the virtue of it, isn't it? Because all your chance creation becomes quite organic. The point where you don't have these circuits in your football, these mechanisms that you fall back on again and again and again to create chances, you kind of ad hoc your way through it because you have enough gifted footballers on the pitch at the same time. And that is
exactly what Thomas Müller was complaining about in his interview post-match. He was complaining about having that, yeah, somehow in their heads, that mental lack of freedom to be able to play, whether that is down to players on the pitch or an, you know, subconscious dig at Tuchel, as we said. Yeah, it's an interesting comment. Interesting thought as well, that third goal when Frimpong has it on the right, maybe it's not too big a deal because they were already 2-0 down. It's the fifth minute of injury time, but Manuel Neuer's walking back, jogging. So he's certainly not sprinting. There were several Bayern players who were sprinting. Manuel Neuer wasn't among them. And Frimpong hit it.
Going off the corner, I was having a conversation with someone earlier today where I said, well, if you're a Bayern Munich goalkeeper, or if you're a Bayern Munich player and you know the club's history, you understand that weird stuff happens in short periods of time at the end of games. And, you know, ultimately when full time goes, you've won because you're a Bayern Munich player. I get it from that perspective, but it felt like a kind of him inserting himself into the game.
I found it a bit late, yeah. When I saw him go up, if this were maybe 3 or 4 minutes earlier, yeah. Now it seems a bit pointless. And then also, as we said, he goes up for the header with Jonathan Tarr and loses it outright. Absolutely no chance. Jonathan Tarr does absolutely doesn't even clears the ball with such ease.
He was also
a great finish. Yeah.
He was also incredibly composed the entire game. There's a few passes he hit straight out of the pitch when he was trying to
been
find
like that, his way back. I feel,
yeah.
Stefan.
Absolutely. I think you could even...
I wonder, just to be defend Neuer a little bit. Yeah, you're right. He has been a bit dodgy since he came back from injury. But then again, and maybe it's not the best comparison. I've just been watching United on Sunday evening now, and Onana's making the same issues. I wonder if it's a bit of a general footballing thing of goalkeepers being forced to play out from the back all the time, and it's all like little set piece situations where the goalkeeper's waiting, and you've got 2 or 3 forwards waiting to press, and they're having to find that set piece way out. Yeah, maybe just a little bit of defence for Neuer there. But yeah, some of his passes were absolutely wayward.
Just to bring it back to Leverkusen before we wrap up, the only things I wanted to add as well was that to add to what you said, Seb, about the brilliance of Florian Wirtz, in that first game, actually, the thing that I really took away from that was that, of course, Bayern kind of sucker punched them at the start with that Harry Kane goal, which, you know, you'll never score an easier goal than that. But as the game went on, I felt like Leverkusen were controlling the game more and more and more. As you said, Boniface could have won it, but the thing that really stood out to me was that Florian Wirtz just had the absolute freedom of that Bayern half for large chunks of that game, and that was obviously when we're in the midst of Joshua Kimmich is in a number 6, he's a new defensive midfielder, and that was clear for all to see. And going into this game, you know, I was saying that this game will be won or lost on whether Bayern have learned that lesson and whether they have some way of stopping Florian Wirtz. And admittedly, when I saw Eric Dier in the lineup, I thought, okay, he's going to play Dier as that kind of holding midfielder. And, you know, he's not the best player in the world, but that is his trade. His trade is to be the player at the base of midfield and kind of get in the way of those passes and things. Obviously, it didn't work out at all. And again, Wirtz just... And now, this isn't just because Bayern were poor. It's obviously because he's such a brilliant player and he's such an outstanding exploiter of space, if you will. But he just had so much space in this game time and time and time again. And you know, there's a lot of people, the natural comparison to Jamal Musiala, it was right there in front of us all, and two different players and two different circumstances, obviously. But where Musiala had been completely crowded out by a really impressive Leverkusen defence, Bayern, almost just to the point of neglect, just completely almost ignored the fact that Florian Wirtz was just drifting in and out of that final third with no one keeping an eye on him at all.
Yeah, I felt a little bit sorry for Musiala because I feel like they're not quite the same player in my mind. Like they do different things to an extent, but like they're an example. Their form at the moment and the season generally is an example of what happens when, you know, depending on what's happening around you. So, like Leverkusen brought a really well-oiled group of players into that side. A lot of players who are playing right at the top of their form, We've mentioned some of the absentees, but Grimaldo, Xhaka, even Nathan Teller after a few games, these are players playing the best football of their career. Wirtz has every reason to kind of be included there as well. Jonathan Tarr, his kind of renaissance has been an amazing thing, actually, under Alonso. That's been one of the great stories at Leverkusen. Musiala, like, what is, from a Bayern Munich perspective, what is the dynamic that you trust within that team? What is the thing that you expect to see to work really, really well? Like, there isn't really a thing there. Like, there's sort of fragments of footballing chemistry between Sané and Kane, and when he was in the side, Davis and Kane. But the entire year has been built around, let's try this guy here, and we're going to have an argument about what this player does and what his role can be and what his limitations are. And when you chuck a Musiala into that and expect him to be a difference maker, maybe you get away with it against Darmstadt or maybe a kind of, I was going to say Dortmund, but sorry, Stefan, I saw your face. I couldn't do it to you. You get my point, though. Like, they're two players who exist in entirely different situations at the moment. And you're kind of like Wirtz profits, Musiala suffers. And like, if ever a game proved it, it's kind of Saturday, unfortunately, for Musiala, who I felt like, again, taking the aim at the people who dropped into the Bundesliga for the first time all year and had a go at Musiala and kind of dismissed him as a myth. No, he's a fantastic footballer. Every bit as good as Florian Wirtz in my mind, and will have every bit as bright a future. But it's in a team at the moment which just doesn't suit him.
Yeah, which I guess brings us back to Thomas Tuchel, which we've already covered. So, Matt, any final parting pearls of wisdom before we wrap things up?
No, just the look going forward, I think, is where Leverkusen go now. We have 13 games to go, 5 points clear. Still clearly an awful long way to go. 39 points to play for, if my very dodgy maths is correct. And history perhaps speaks against them, because of, the history of 2002 and acquiring that moniker of Leverkusen and never having won the Bundesliga before anyway, being in a completely new position, that all speaks against it. Can they now deal with that pressure? It's going to be week in, week out now. It's going to be almost like a countdown, almost. At what point can they make it certain? At what point can they win it? They've also got two other fronts to keep fighting on, still in the in the German Cup, in the semi-final against Dusseldorf in the Europa League. Where I suspect that Alonso will want to make good that semi-final defeat to Roma last year as well. So it might depend on where key Europa League fixtures fall in comparison to key Bundesliga fixtures around that. On the other hand, current form, I can't think of a single Bundesliga team who's going to trouble them. You think on uncertain form, the trip away to Dortmund is a problematic one. Dortmund had one of their actual better performances this weekend, the win against Freiburg. You can potentially see a situation there where that's a stumbling block. Having said that, though, so many things are in Leverkusen's favour now that weren't in Borussia Dortmund's favour, particularly even the size of the club, and that's where them being a lot smaller than Dortmund plays into their hands. There isn't that intense local pressure, let alone intense nationwide or even global pressure, which Borussia Dortmund might have felt. There's not that pressure of having been challengers to Bayern for the past 5 or 6, 7 years and find out to do it. That Leverkusen don't have that pressure. There's no intense media spotlight on Bayer Leverkusen. If you want to read any top interviews or exclusive stuff about Leverkusen, there is no dedicated Leverkusen newspaper. Everything appears in the Cologne or Dusseldorf press. Leverkusen absolutely do have a dedicated, very community-based, hardcore support. Of course it exists, it absolutely does exist, but it's nowhere near on the scale of what surrounds Borussia Dortmund or Schalke or Cologne or Gladbach. So they don't have, they won't have to deal with it with any of that. They can operate in a calm environment, keep doing their thing, away from the spotlight, from week to week, and I think it speaks ultimately in very much in their favour.
Yeah, I think there's the temptation to draw comparisons last season where Dortmund obviously kind of surged to the front of the queue and then tripped up on the final spot. But I guess the difference here maybe, and maybe it's not a difference, maybe this was the same last year, but as much as I can see Leverkusen dropping points this season, I just feel like Bayern are more than capable of dropping more. I think that's the difference between Bayern of 3 or 4 years ago and this Bayern team. You always get, there's always been clubs who've pulled ahead at certain points of the season, but there was always an inevitability that Bayern would get their house in order and just blitz the rest of the season. I just don't get the impression that Bayern are going to be able to kind of tighten the ship and wait for Leverkusen to drop points to capitalize on it.
100%, because that's the assumption, isn't it, that Bayern Munich are going to run the table. I mean, I can't see that happening at all. Also, that Borussia Dortmund side last season was an individual-led team. Like, you know, the tenor of its performance were dictated by high-performing individuals, whereas Leverkusen are a system-based side. Yeah, they have really influential players within that, but they are about the system, as Saturn and I proved. And so, like, an injury, a lack of fitness, being stretched by demands of like continental and cup football, it's not going to impact them in quite the same way either. So like I can't, like, either the Dortmund game is tricky when they go there. That, of course, it will be. That'll be an occasion and it's something to look forward to. But I don't know where they're going to drop 5 points, and I don't expect, you know, I think they'll have to drop more than that for Bayern to catch them. And I don't see where that's going to happen. So I'm not going to tempt fate by saying it's done, but they're not just a favourite now, they're a heavy, heavy favourite.
Yeah.
I think if I can finish with a quick analogy, I think if last season was two tortoises going racing for the finish,
falling over each other.
Yeah. this season, it really is a case of the tortoise and the hare, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it a hare?
I think it's a hare. Yeah, but it's a hare. In that analogy, the tortoise wins, so I'm not quite sure who's
who. Oh, good point.
The hare gets cocky, yeah. Like it stops and it has something to eat, has a bit of sleep, yeah. And you know.
Good point. I've not thought that through, but yeah.
The plucky little Bayern Munich just keeps going.
Yeah, well, the Bundesliga title race might not be done, but this podcast is done as we approach the hour mark, and I've already used up far too much of these good gentlemen's time on a Sunday evening, so... I think we'll probably call it there, lads. Thank you so much for joining once again, Seb. It's always a pleasure, and Matt as well. It's always great having you guys on the show. Manu will be back this week. The regular scheduled programming will be back. Don't worry, I've read your hate mail. Don't worry, he will be here soon. I will be passing on the torch back to him. Nothing of the sort. But yeah, it's great to have Manu back. And yeah, as always,
Tuchel, that was Manu Ryan.
As always, please do consider subscribing if you guys want to read our newsletters, bonus shows to boot. And yeah, until next time, I guess I'll use Manu's fated words by saying auf Wiedersehen.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.